Greetings, folks. Glad to have you here. I'm Henrik, and this is a radio program that exposes and inquire about anything that is related to some of the biggest issues that we face in the West, and also the geopolitical game and the big picture by the establishment that is conspiring against us, against our replacement, and against our interests. There's a lot of layers to all of this, of course, politically and ideologically, spiritually and metaphysically as well. We discuss many of the tools that they use against us, and we want to try to give you a broader picture of the nature of those who have, through their actions, declared themselves our enemies. You might not agree with all our guests. Sometimes it gets metaphysical, sometimes speculative, and conspiratorial. In other words, not just about the level one obvious that is right in front of your eyes, but those things that lie behind the surface that goes a bit deeper. But we think these things are good to both consider and be aware of so that you at the very least understand the argument. You can listen to more radio at redicecreations.com or redicesradio.net. Now, the spiritual argument is an important factor both related to tradition and culture and how it can be used against us or removed from us to later attract us to a facsimile. And, you know, sometimes the spiritual question is kind of neglected a bit, largely due to the urgency of everything that is happening in our immediate surrounding. We are going to spend some time talking about this today with a special focus on the Catholic history as it's tied to Europe today. As you might know, I'm tied to my Nordic roots, our traditions that we already have up in Scandinavia, and I was never into Christianity. But I think it's important to see beyond these barriers, if you will, if we are to rescue Europe from the ongoing disarray and find a common interests above that of Jesus or Odin, Thor and Frey and the other gods. Now, I understand that Christianity, whether we like it or not, has a history with Europe now, despite that it was an invader in the same way that another Middle Eastern religion, Islam, is now invading Europe. Remarkably, it was in many ways brought in the same kind of way by a corrupt leadership, by the kings, by the politicians, that was bypassing the will of the people. It was perhaps done for political and diplomatic reasons, and also probably reasons of personal gain. Can't really know all these things, but we can see today, of course, how the politicians and the establishment is bypassing the will of the people once again. We'll talk more about some of that later. Our guest is Jennifer Upton. She was born in Kentucky, moved to San Francisco, where she studied poetry and read extensively in Jungian psychology. She has a lifelong interest in the metaphysical poetry of the world, which in later life developed into interest in traditional metaphysics and comparative religion. This drew her to the writings of the perennialists and traditionalist school founded by René Guénon. In 88, she converted to Islam and joined a Persian Sufi order. In 1990, she joined the Meryami Tariq under Fritjof Schuon. In 96, she moved on to Eastern Orthodox Christianity. She returned to Kentucky with her husband Charles Upton in 2004. We had Charles with us, by the way, talking more about René Guénon. But the following year, her book Dark Way to Paradise, Dante's Inferno in Light of the Spiritual Path, was published by Sophia Perennis. And her latest is The Ordeal of Mercy, Dante's Purgatorio in the Light of the Spiritual Path, that came out earlier this year. Well, stay tuned, a different discussion ahead. Hope you like it. Hi, Jenny. Thank you for coming on the program with us. It's nice to have you here today. Hope you're doing well.
I am, and it's good to be with you.
Well, thank you so much. Well, now for those who don't know, of course, you are the wife of Charles Upton, who we had with us, I think it's quite a few years ago now, actually, speaking about some of his work and whatnot. So it's good to connect with you as well.
Yes.
All right. Well, we have a new book that you have coming out soon that we're going to talk about today called The Ordeal of Mercy. You have a couple of other titles in the past. We'll see if we can talk maybe about some of those later. But before we talk more about the new book and why you wanted to write it and everything else, what do you think our audience should know about you and your background before we start more on the book?
Well, all right. I suppose I am. Earlier in my life, I was a poet in the San Francisco Bay Area. In fact, I have a book of poems that was published here in Kentucky recently, but the poems go back to my days in San Francisco. And I met my husband there, Charles Upton. We lived in the Bay Area for a great many years until about 2004. Then we decided it would be better for a number of reasons to move here to Kentucky. I'm from Kentucky originally, which is why we chose Kentucky.
All right, very good. Are you happy there?
Oh, yes, I really am. I feel, you know, our lives are in better shape than they were in California, and that makes an immense difference, too. And I like the area. We live in the Lexington. That's the heart of the bluegrass. It's one of the more beautiful parts of the world, I think. Beautiful parts of the country, anyway.
Right, so. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you want to share this with us or not, but why did you want to get out specifically out of California? Were things changing in a direction you didn't like?
Yes. So one thing is, as I say, it was easier for us to stabilize our lives. We had a piece of property we could sell at the height of the escalation of housing prices, and that helped us a great deal. But also, it was beginning to be, like I told my husband, we lived sort of in a middle-of-the-road place. And what was happening on one side of us, very, very rich people were moving in, and on the other side, very, very poor people were moving in. And I didn't feel there was much room in the middle. If you go to the middle part of the United States, I think you have more room for something like what we used to call a middle class. And while it might be that's more or less where we are, you know.
Right, right. Now, let's see here. Let's kind of get into the book a little bit. I'm ill prepared. I'll be honest about that. I have not read the book. I have not even read about the book. It's not out yet. It's going to be out probably at the end of this month when we're doing this recording by angelicopress.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
yeah.
Obviously you wrote to us, let me just explain that. You wrote to us a while ago, you wanted to come on. I think we have, we might have some disagreements when it comes to theology or background or even intentions in terms of where, what would be good for Europe and whatnot. But I wanted to bring you on to hear more about what you have to say. And I wanted to hear more
would be happy to talk about that. Because I wrote the book in part because, as I say, I think Christianity is being hidden. I think the spirituality of the West, and a lot of this is contained in Christianity, people don't know it. They look at televangelists and they think that's the sum total of Christianity. And that's
right.
That's what I'm working against, essentially. And yeah, and also, I think, now, this is where you may not agree with me. I think that Christianity is an integral part of the European spirit at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree with Carl Jung and Nietzsche that it was imposed. Let me tell you something. It's not a Semitic religion. It had plenty of time to become the world Semitic religion. That didn't happen. It moved north toward Europe, and Islam came in. Judaism was always too ethnically based. Shall I go on here? One thing people don't see about religions, all religions, they are all ethnically based. Now, you get religions like Judaism or Hinduism that are enclosed in an ethnicity. It would be very difficult to be an Orthodox Jew if you weren't born that way. And traditional Hinduism, I know there's lots of people running around saying they're following a guru. Traditional Hinduism tells you you better be born in one of the four castes to really be a Hindu. And I know that. I knew Ramakumar Swami, who was a Hindu early in his life, and he was very emphatic about that. Whereas Christianity, Buddhism, and Islam they're open to all ethnicities, and this is right. But let me tell you, they are all ethnically based. Islam is the religion of the Semitic world, the universal religion. There's, other religions that aren't. Buddhism, which was born in India, migrated to East Asia. Its ethnicity, if you want to be a Buddhist, you're going to have to deal with the ethnicity of the East Asians at some point, whether you like it or not. And there are deep truths in Buddhism, but if you want to actually be a Buddhist, you almost have to be beholden to them. This is maybe so. I know a lot of people in the West want to be Buddhist and sort of be beholden to the secular world.
But right.
The secular world is not religious. I'm sorry. And then we come to Christianity. Its ethnic basis is Europe. If you want to be a Christian, you have to look to European civilization, other people. This doesn't mean that other ethnic entities don't have very good people, don't have saints. And it's a wonderful thing to be a saint, whoever or wherever you are, or what time you live in. But these people don't have to look, when they look towards civilization and a culture, to the West. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I don't know if I agree with you, though. I mean, some people would explain that the church, especially in Europe, but in the Western world at large, is now turning against the ethnic Europeans. It's turning its back on them. How do we explain that?
Do you want to know what I have to say about that?
Sure.
All right. Now, and here we come to my issues with my publisher. You see, right now, I attend a traditional Catholic Mass, and I and the few people I believe I'm with, we don't believe that the present Pope, in fact, we don't believe that a number of the other popes preceding him, even this wonderful John Paul II, everybody loved. I really don't love John Paul II. I think there were problems with him even, myself. But we don't think they were real popes. I think the church, I think that the main church, Catholic Church, is totally apostate. And let me tell you, that's very different from being corrupt. A lot of people say, didn't the church have problems centuries and centuries ago? Yeah, and weren't those problems very problematical? Yes, the Renaissance popes were corrupt. They were very corrupt, and no doubt that fed the Reformation. If they had been better people, there might not have even been a Reformation. I don't know. But what they didn't do, but what they didn't turn on the essence of the church. At its heart, the church was what it was. It had the sacraments. It had the spirit. And all this goes back to the apostles. A central thing of Christianity, and this tends to be true of some other traditions, is you have apostolic succession. What the church is, and even in its form, I suspect that what we call the Mass, a lot of that goes back to the early apostles. And there was a kind of, we know that Christ, in Christianity, Christ was a revelation. What's said in Christianity is, unlike with the Quran, we have a book that's a revelation. We have a person who's a revelation. So this, an incarnation, so this feeds our whole view of what the divine is. Now, I suspect that essentially what we call the Mass or Divine Liturgy and Orthodoxy, and I think both those traditions have their own validities. A lot of people don't. A lot of people are going to take one or the other, but you'll have to talk to them about that. I believe that that goes back to the apostles. I know it's said, and someone I followed a lot, Ramakumaraswamy, said that the Christian revelation didn't end with the death and resurrection of Christ. It ended with the death of apostles. And that puts a whole dimension to the tradition.
Right.
This is different from Protestants who say believe in the Bible. The Bible is inspired, but the Bible is not the Quran.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
Well.
So that's what I said.
Sure. Now, let me. Yeah, because I mean, obviously, I understand your criticism against the Pope. I don't know how any.
Well, okay. Let me tell you how it works. The Pope. What I'm tending to say is the Pope first turned on the Christian tradition, and now he's turning on Europe. That shouldn't be a surprise to anybody.
Right.
It's not the place. Christianity needs to defend itself. And in a strange way, I'll say that Europe still is Christendom. I know that most people don't call themselves Christian. I know that a lot of people will say it's outrageous to say this, but I'm saying this. How can the Pope agree to something like he is with this present immigration crisis that destroys Europe, destroys Christendom? How can a Christian want the destruction of Christendom, for
right.
instance?
Yeah. I know.
Yeah, and
I know.
So
well,
hasn't
the Pope? I mean, if we look at that from an American perspective for a moment too, some have argued that the Pope is, for example, happy to see how Mexico and many Latin Americans are coming into America because they are highly Catholic still, many of them. That they see that as an increase of the multitude of Catholics in America. In other words, they're not tied to either the European stock of Americans or the Europeans. It seems like they take anybody that they can get, basically, right?
Well, all right, fine. Let anybody be a Catholic or Christian that wants to be. But I have issues. I actually like Mexico. I like Mexican culture. But there's no reason to allow this flood of immigrants into our country. I don't think you have to agree to that to be a Christian. All right, I know some people who, I don't know these people personally, in this area who left a very conservative Catholic mass because the priest was pushing immigration, and they didn't feel that was necessary or warranted, and I don't think it is either, to tell you the truth.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you definitely hit the nail on the head when you talked about the current Pope, though. I mean, he definitely is a very different Pope. I mean, it's been reformed over a long period of time, but I mean, many people have definitely tied many of his comments to he seems more to be a socialist and a Marxist than he is a Catholic. You know what I mean?
Well, I think he is more a socialist and Marxist, and this probably goes back to that Vatican II Council. It set up the basis to, instead of following what we call traditional Christian values or the old church. I love the old church. Somebody that many of your listeners may have known about, who was actually not religious, a man, Michael Collins Piper. I never will forget one point he said, you know, I really love the old church. And I was impressed that somebody like him would say that. You know, it was a good feeling. And let's say the old church, because the church has changed so much that it looks to me like a new church. Now, they will not, my publisher would not agree with that. I put some things I call the new church, the Novus Ordo church, the new order. And given its present affiliation with what we call the New World Order, I think that's an apt term, my publisher said, do say something like post-cons, you know, after the councils. And I did go along with it because I want the book will be published. But I did have to face the things he was asking me to delete, and I sort of had to bite the bullet on that because I did have a contract, and I guess I could have just pulled out. I just it was a little late, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, share with us a bit more of what you had to remove, so if people pick up a copy of the book, they know kind of what some of the things that you wanted to include that you couldn't for at least this run of the book.
Yes, actually, we may put that on our website.
I think you should. Yeah, I think you should.
Yeah. Anyway, well, let me start. For one thing, I call the present church Novus Ordo because they changed the Mass. I am not convinced the Mass is valid or the sacraments are valid. Now, this is iffy. There's a priest whose Mass I attend in Kentucky, who recently, he left what I'm calling the Novus Ordo Church for the reasons I'm talking about. But before he functioned as a priest, he got a more traditional, ordination because he felt like it was valid. And I don't, one of the things that was deleted is I've made a long quote from Ramakumara Swami about extreme unction. The new church doesn't have extreme unction. Extreme unction has to do directly with death. Now, you can have the last rites and not die because nobody knows for sure when you're going to die. But traditionally, death was supposed to loom as a possibility. And nowadays, they just call it the sacrament of the sick. It's not the same thing. And Kumaraswamy said he doubted it was valid, and my publisher got very upset with that. Mm-hmm. Well, there's not much I can do. And he got upset with Novus Ordo, and Charles agrees with me. And we had to delete a lot of his notes, which contained material like that.
That's too bad. Well, let's talk about that a little bit more. I mean, what do you think the current Catholic Church are up to? I mean, they're obviously reforming. This has happened many times over time, as you said, from all the ecumenical councils to the big change when Vatican II came in the 60s. But are they trying to appeal to some kind of populist movement? They're trying to appeal to kind of liberal modern values in Europe and the West. Is that why they're reforming themselves in the way they are, or explain that a bit more for us?
Well, what they do, they used to have with Vatican II this term aggiornamento. We've got to keep up with the times. We've got to relate to the times. Well, the whole purpose of religion is to relate us to eternity, not to time.
And tradition,
yes. That's the whole reason for it. And also, they want to be, quote-unquote, socially relevant. Well, in these terms, what's social relevancy? I mean, you know, yeah, I'm not against corporate works of charity, as they call it, you know, feeding poor people and all that's, but they take that as everything. They secularize it. And one thing to explain about Christian charity is Christians always say, is it good for one's soul? And these people almost always just see a material basis. And they never ask, what would these people need in terms of their soul? All right, I applied that to the immigrants that charity's being shown to in Europe. And I said, is it even written, never even forget what it's like for the indigenous population of Europe. Is it even good for their soul?
Right.
They're lied to. They're abandoning a lot. They may be abandoning families. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true. Yeah, that's true.
This can't be very good for them.
No. Well, you know, the Catholic Church and the Pope seem to be more interested in these times about gay marriage, commenting on aliens living out in the universe, in some cases even getting involved in scientific matters and all this kind of stuff, as opposed to trying to preserve the values that they have had within the Church for, you know, well, it depends on what region you're talking about, but at least southern to Central Europe about 1500 years or something like that.
Oh, that's exactly it. It's bizarre. it's bizarre. I mean, aliens? I don't, you know, there was a traditional, an Orthodox priest in California. A lot of people don't like him. He hated the Western Church. I don't agree with him on that. But he was talking about how there's something almost demonic about a lot of these aliens. I would not try to say we have to communicate with them or anything. I think just forget them or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're very much concerned. And also, Benedict Ratzinger, he was the, quote, conservative pope. A lot of people thought, well, he would just restore the church tradition. I never thought he would, to tell you the truth.
No.
But he did an encyclical where he essentially says he supports the whole New World Order financially. And it's just ridiculous. I think that right now the church has joined the world, and they'll go along with this universalist, universals in a sense aren't bad, I don't think. But there's some real universals there. But the way universality is being used in our day and age is just terrible. And gay marriage, that was never part of Christianity. That was never part of, I don't know, a religion it was ever part of offhand.
Right, exactly.
You know, I can't tell you that.
Well, they're trying to, sorry for interrupting, Jenny, but it feels to me that they're trying to appeal to people that kind of already resent the church anyway. So instead of, I guess, adopting and owning or becoming part of the theology that they have as tenants originally, they are simply trying to reform themselves and become kind of representatives of the homosexual movement. When in the eyes of many homosexuals, they are hated and despised by them anyway. Correct?
Exactly. It is bizarre. I quipped about this pope, or I call him Bergoglio. I don't think that was his original name.
Right.
That the people who like him tend to not like Catholicism. that's the way it works. And I don't think they're going to get anywhere by throwing away their values. And that they lose members. I don't know. It's all very strange. And all this is a big chunk of giving people, we are traditionally part of Western civilization. And even people who don't have anything to do with the church, I think this sort of pulls the rug out from under all of us.
Yeah.
It just really, and that's what's horrible. It just absolutely does that. And I don't know. Yeah, it seems also with the populations, we used to call it the first world or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Our governments don't care one bit what happens to us.
Absolutely not. They have turned against us.
They have.
They've become hostile against us and our interests, and they're supposed to represent us. And unfortunately, the church has joined in on this. I mean, I can speak specifically about the church in Sweden, but I mean, they have become one of the most politically correct organizations you can ever imagine. We had a female cardinal who recently advocated that the whole church to be converted into facilities for the migrants, and the recent stunt, she actually said that a part of the church, the Catholic Church in Stockholm, should be converted into a kind of a safe space for Muslims, like a prayer corner for Muslims inside of the church. You know,
I know it's so bizarre, and uh, I uh, it reminds me, I read an article somewhere on the internet, and that there was a church in Germany where they were taking down crosses and the altar.
That's right.
So,
yep.
Yeah, I mean, this is spiritual suicide. I mean, we ought to say, this is our spiritual tradition, we're keeping it, and if you're a Muslim and we're giving you charity, you're just going to have to accept this. We're not going to say you should be Christian, but you're going to have to accept that we're Christian.
Yeah.
You know?
Of course. Yeah, well, we talk about these double standards all the time, but I mean, in light of this, obviously then you can understand why people, I mean, it's not about people turning their backs on the church, because the church has already turned their backs on the people, so the people is simply just walking away from it all, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, they are. And also, something I don't know if I talked about it, and one of the reasons I wrote my book is, the whole understanding of what Christianity is getting completely lost. And a lot of people who call themselves Christians, as far as I can tell, don't really know much about what Christianity has traditionally been, particularly in the United States, where you get a lot of Protestantism that can go in all kinds of strange directions. You know, just really get so watered down. I met a woman once who was from a Sunday school class or something, and she said something like, how is suffering any good? What benefit can, but you know, we all suffer. In our tradition, Christianity always emphasizes suffering through love. Not that you go seek suffering. I don't have to. A great many people don't have to. It just comes.
Yeah, and these times especially, yeah. It's all around.
If it comes, you go straight through it and use it as an opportunity to deepen and increase love. And that's an essential part of Christianity, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing I wanted to say is, well, right now, I understand why people don't like Christian charity. If it means you're turning your churches into mosques, that's too bad. But one thing that happened, particularly during the Middle Ages, is why this emphasis on charity and kindness to strangers? I'll tell you why. Europe had a great warrior caste. We have lovely idealistic images of knights. But knights were real warriors and therefore had a ferocious quality, as all warriors do. So in order to balance that, they had to develop, we'll be kind orphans and we will accept love. You know, the tradition of romantic love has everything to do with the warrior caste. It's not a priestly caste, or if you wanted to go back to the Hindus, it wouldn't pertain to the Brahmin caste, so much as I believe it's the Kshatriya caste, the warrior, the knighthood, and noble caste. And we don't understand. These are the basis of our traditions, and I always use the point of, look at the pets we tend to love. We love dogs and cats. We don't love sheep. For instance, and I don't particularly love rabbits. Some are sort of cute. But dogs and cats are predators.
Mm-hmm.
And they're definitely predators, and they mean business. I have a cat. They mean business if they go after prey.
Oh yeah.
So it's interesting that it's that double thing. On one hand, there's the warrior. On the other hand, there's courtesy, kindness, and a willingness to not hurt the helpless.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit later, I want to ask you a little bit more about, because you mentioned something before that Christianity is something that wasn't imposed. I wanted to ask you about that later, specifically more in the context of at least what I know from Northern Europe and that experience right there. I suspect we'll disagree, but we'll get to that later. Before we talk about that, though,
I have something I want to read to you.
Sure, sure. Let's talk about that later. Now, before we go there, tell us a bit more about the root of Christianity, its true purpose, and how that relates to the development of Europe. It's a huge topic, of course, but kind of take us through that a little bit if you can.
Well, the first thing you say is, well, the root is in the divine, as you would want a religion to be. Obviously, it came from Jewish roots. You can't deny that. It's different from Judaism. It's particularly different from the religion of Pharisees, who were no longer following the prophets, it looks like. Its essential feature is incarnation. God incarnates. And so this is very important for human beings. It gives, according to Christian tradition, it gives people immortality and salvation. But also it shows the dignified status of the human being. I think in the modern world we forget that. We don't see at all that to be a human being is to carry within oneself a degree of dignity. Now we spit on that dignity. We're quote fallen beings. We don't live up to it, but it's there. It's intrinsically within us, and so that's part of what Christianity is about. Okay, it did originate in the Semitic world, but almost immediately it goes to Rome. Rome is European, and and I believe that from the very beginning it was supposed to be Roman. You know, it was supposed to go to Europe, and it went to Europe through Rome. I suspect, and I don't know, this is not a traditional interpretation, but when Christ says, given to Caesar what is Caesar and unto God what is God's, there's an implication there that Rome will be central to Christianity. And like the Western Church calls itself Roman Catholic, but then you have the Eastern Church. But the Eastern Church looked at itself as Rome. In the East, the Eastern Emperor looked at himself as the protector of Christianity as long as he was there. Then, at one point, the center of the Orthodox Church, or at least they said it, moved to Moscow. Moscow used to call itself the Third Rome. So Rome, I know that Rome was an empire, but by the time Christianity spreads through its contact with Rome, Rome's no longer an empire, and what you have is a cultural change.
Right.
And I don't know, does that explain the origins? I suppose in a way it does, yes.
Before we move on from there, let me ask you a little bit more about that in terms of, you know, who wrote the Bible, because obviously we do have, rewriting of it, or it's translated, it's picked up. And I'm not talking about the Pentateuch, the first five books now of Moses and all that Old Testament. I'm talking about the New Testament. And there is something that goes on from what you just explained in terms of the essential importance of Christianity to Rome at the time, that it kind of came out of this environment. Some people have said that, Josephus Flavius, for example, from the Flavian dynasty, a convert who was Jewish himself, but that he was partial of bringing the New Testament together as an attempt to try both to control the Jewish rebellion in Judea, the Roman province at the time, but also as a way of kind of trying to sell that and have also the undercurrents of Christianity, which was bubbling up at the time. To be supportive, basically, within the Roman Empire. I mean, later it became the official state religion, but before that, there was quite some calamity with with the Jews in Judea and all that stuff. So is there something to that, do you think, that who put the books together to form the Bible, in your opinion?
Well, I'm going to go. I don't know what this what was done. Essentially, the traditional way of saying it is there were many books there. There are books that were accepted as part of the canon and books that weren't. But the traditional way it's looked at is the early church councils were divinely inspired by the Holy Spirit to make the right decision. And we get the Bible from those early church councils. In fact, Protestants will say, the church is no good. I believe in the Bible. And the answer to that is, which came first, the church or the Bible? The church came first, and the church gave us the Bible in its form and told us which books they considered canonical and which books they didn't. I don't think the other books were particularly false. I'm sure some of them were false. But that's the traditional answer. And the reason I go with that is, when I look at a tradition, I tend to look at what's already there. I'll do this with any tradition. I'll do this with Islam, and I'll tend to accept what it says about itself. And I'll say this, something I wanted to say. I think there's a lot of good in Islam, but that doesn't mean that Muslims belong in Europe.
Right.
There's a big difference. Somebody can come and say, well, don't you think this religion has something very spiritual about it? Yes, I do. But it doesn't belong in Europe.
Well, exactly. I got to jump on that. Just because I criticize not only Islamic, it's Arabic people, and some of them, you know, Arabs, and many of them are Muslims, some are secular and whatnot. I just don't think they don't belong in Europe. It doesn't mean that I hate Islam or have some problem with Islam. I mean, I think it's a great thing for them. It's what they developed. I really don't care about it. I don't think it's our mission either, nor as Europeans or in the hands of America or APAC or anything like that, to try to, clean out Islam, because it's a problem if it's contained into the region where it arose. I mean, I know some people would disagree with that, considering how it did take over certain areas. It has definitely conquered. Europe has been plagued many, many times by trying to keep Islam out of its gates, if you will, and that has led to a lot of problems. Yeah. But as long as it's not expansive and take over territory where it today doesn't belong, I don't have a problem with it.
That's pretty much what I feel, you know. And minorities in these could exist in Europe or whatever, but this whole thing that, I mean, Muslims on YouTube are saying, we're going to take over. And I don't know whether or not they can take over, but if someone says they're going to rob you, you don't say, well, let them rob me, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's a naivety of the highest proportions here we're talking about.
Yes, it is. So.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about Rome, and okay, you take the traditional view. Have you thought about that at all in terms of, well, these councils that were held during the Roman period, do you believe that they were divinely inspired, and all the people that were there came together at that time to pick the books that they did, and they excluded the books they did for a good reason, and all that's good?
I'm inclined to believe that. I accept the tradition as is.
Okay. Yeah.
Simply because that's what I'm working with. You know, a tradition is something you work with. As I said, I tend to accept what traditions say about themselves.
Right, yeah.
Because a religion, you know something about it if you're inside of it that you don't know if you're on the outside looking in. And that's something I respect, that traditions have their outer forms, and then they have an inner essence. Now, Islam really separates this stuff. It has the law, the Sharia, which is an anathema to a lot of Westerners, I understand it. And then it has things like the Sufi tradition, where the mystical path is. But in Christianity, that doesn't work for us. Our inner, we don't have that kind of separation. You go into a church, you go to Mass, and basically the mysteries are there staring you in the face. This doesn't mean that everybody picks up on that. But the people who can pick up on it. And all religions, you have an understanding when you're on the inside that you can't have when you're on the outside.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk a bit about more how the development of where Christianity developed from. There certainly was a lot of suppression of the Christians in the early days. And of course, interestingly, this turned around later. The Council of Nicaea was in around 325.
Something like that. Yeah.
When things started to come together, these ecumenical councils, there were first, a second, blah, blah, blah. Many of these over time, of course. But I think about 100 years after the Council of Nicaea, the first one, you had things starting to happen in different parts of the world. One of the stories that comes to mind in terms of how Christianity was imposed on people was the story of Hypatia and what happened in Alexandria, where Christians murdered her, basically, over disagreements, obviously, about faith and about where the future lied and everything else. But explain the expansion of Christianity to us, and we can work ourselves further up north, if you will, throughout Europe.
Well,
and how you see it, because obviously I see it, especially in Northern Europe, it was extremely violent when it came in. How do you see this?
Well, I'm not saying there was never violence. But I'm saying the essence of the way it spread wasn't through violence. It couldn't have, it was weak for many years compared to Rome. And then it became the official religion of Rome. Well, at that point, it had more power. Also, at that point, Rome itself was weakened. And I'm not of the school that say that Christianity weakened the empire. I think the empire just weakened probably on its own, because that happens to empires. And Christianity came in and almost gave it a spiritual way to survive, because in some ways Rome survived through medieval Christianity. You had Latin and all that. But it's almost a spiritualized Roman Empire. Wait a minute, I'm not answering your question. I'm not sure that violence played a big role in it. And
was it just? I mean, obviously, we have stories up. We can get up north later. It's a different thing. I don't know every instance of every aspect of how it expanded, but tell us at least on how you think that it was adopted by the people and why it was adopted. I mean, we have, for example, at the time of, let's say, the migration age, right? We had people from northern part of Europe that migrated further down, you know, the Goths and some of these things. And some of these people, they Christianized along the way. In some cases, it was for political reasons. It was for reasons of if the king in the region already was Christian, it was a better opportunity for them to trade and have peace with them as opposed to fight with them. So that was done for political reasons, as opposed to, let's say, spiritual reasons, right?
Well, I think, I'm not saying that never happened. I think all the religions that spread had, in some cases, there were spiritual reasons, in many cases. I'm not denying there weren't political reasons in definite cases, but then there were political reasons to stay, say, with classical paganism, and that sort of thing. You know, an interesting development that died out and something a lot of Christians are fascinated by is the old Celtic church, which had a beautiful spirit to it. And that was St. Patrick, and it had that closeness to nature and that kind of thing. That church actually ended up more or less dying out, but I can't think that church was imposed on people. And I'm not saying that, well, it was never imposed, because I think all these things get imposed. But I'm saying there was a great spirit and there was a willingness to accept it among many people. Not among all people, but among many people. Mm-hmm. And there were saints. The old saints were interesting. I'm not sure that we have, I don't know if we have saints like that now or not. The churches have definite processes of canonization, but nobody ever says they're the only saints. They're just the only saints that God has willed that we fully recognize. In fact, I tend to believe that there are hidden saints. I don't know where they are, but it's my inclination to look at it that way.
Mm-hmm, right. Well, you know, I'm not going to go through all the horror stories of what Olaf Tryggvason did, you know, in Norway when he attempted to unify Norway under Christianity. There's a lot of horror stories there and whatnot. But
on the other hand, in recent times, Christian churches are being burned in Norway.
Yeah, definitely. This Varvikenes
so,
that did
you know,
that. You
violence
know,
violence goes, it goes all sorts of ways. So.
But tell us how you think that it fits in with, let's say, our native European tradition. I mean, obviously, the story of Christ fits into a mythological narrative that already had a lot of common with some of the deities that we had to us from pre-Christian traditions, right? I mean, we have these beautiful rune stones in Denmark, for example, where we have people can't make a distinction whether it's actually Odin or if it's Christ that hangs in this tree with runic scriptures around him and everything. I mean, there was a period of dual faith, as some people have called it, obviously that took a lot of to get to that point. That took a lot of bloodshed. There's just no denying that. But tell us about how Christianity, in your opinion, fits into a native European tradition.
Well, I think Christianity absorbed and was to a great degree at one with the European soul. I don't think myself, I mean, you can disagree with me, but that it's absolutely necessary to go back to the old indigenous faiths, which in any case, it's a little hard to know about them. And Judaism couldn't have done them. I don't think Islam could do this, but Christianity blended and became totally European. As I said, that's why its homeland is Europe. And I think once you get things like the Arthurian romances, things like that, that's beginning to show a deep blend between what's Christian and what existed before and what will exist in eternity.
What would you call it? The Arthurian romance? What is that? Arthurian romances?
King Arthurian.
Okay, gotcha. I just didn't hear that. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, exactly. That's obviously something which, yeah. The Grail myth is very much a kind of
exactly.
a European
yeah.
thing, and it. Uh-huh. I mean, in that regard, I agree with you. When I think back more to a medieval period of when Christianity was in place, I mean, I personally know the problems that existed before that time, so I have difficulty accepting that for what it is. But if I close my eyes to those things for a moment and just look at it for what it is, I do have an appreciation for that period in Europe, that it seems unique and special in that regard. And it kind of this is also, of course, when the Knights Templar are starting to kind of pop up on the scene, and there's a lot of exciting and interesting things happening, especially with the building of the Gothic cathedrals, you know. So there is a fervor within European tradition at this time, right?
And the Gothic, I love the old cathedrals. I haven't been to Europe a lot. I haven't seen them, but I love the old cathedrals and the stained glass and that sort of thing. I would hate to see, you know, one of the things, many things Muslims on YouTube threaten is a destruction of that kind of thing. I don't feel very good about it.
Yeah, who does, right? Who does?
Yeah,
it's truly remarkable. And of course, many of these buildings now, they stand empty. I mean, that's why some of the governments in Europe are literally considering to either simply knock them down or convert them into housing for the invaders into Europe, because they're just not being used. I mean, this is maybe perhaps a later question, but what kind of, in your opinion, then, if you, I mean, I assume you would want to see a revival of an original Christianity in Europe, and I would assume that you would think that this would put us in a better place overall. What would have to be done here for that to occur, in your opinion?
What would have to be done is quite simply, in religious terms, you talk about faith and what you have before you try to create forms or say have everybody go back to the cathedral to mass when they don't really feel like it. I don't think that would help anything very much. You have to have what you call faith. I think something that's been destructive is when our populations have turned away from Christianity and just become totally secular. This secularness is vicious and has created a great deal of destruction. And we want, right now, let me go on my spiel about the New World Order. They want to create something I call a generic human. And the New Age wants to believe that somehow we're going to get a religion for this generic human being who doesn't exist and therefore needs no religion. We're gender differentiated. This thing that you can choose your own gender sounds ridiculous to me. We're born into certain groups. We're born into certain races, certain ethnicities. Now, we didn't choose any of that. And there's almost an assumption that if you didn't choose something, it's not important. And that's not true at all. All these things are important to who we are. Gender, race, ethnicity, the language we speak. I mean, it's not everything. You know, we have a spirit that in a way transcends. If you look at a spiritual life, we're called to, in a sense, transcend all this, but not to destroy it.
Well, you know, faith is a difficult thing. Let me ask you this.
It's very difficult, yes.
Because let's see here if I can explain what I'm thinking about here. The sciences as we have them today has developed out of an urge to try to understand God. This came directly out of, well, I mean, I can't say that it didn't exist before that, of trying to understand the world and the natural elements around it. That has always been the case. I think many of the gods that come to us from previous pre-Christian traditions is an attempt to try to explain natural phenomena and forces in nature and all these kinds of things. But back to the point, through the reformations of Christianity, you have kind of had a scientific field coming forth. It's an idea of purity, of getting to the core of the issue of what is God, what is it, what makes things tick, how does it work, right? So the more we have gone into that from, let's say, Catholicism, Reformation, Protestantism, Calvinism, scientific fields have kind of like followed on from that. And now we find ourselves in a position where we're extremely materialistics. It's only about if it's provable, you know, on the material basis. That's all it is. And this has kind of led us to a position where we now have excluded things that we consider to be based on superstition or mumbo jumbo, or call it whatever you want, right? So the faith has been slowly worked out of the picture and disappeared. And it's just not something that you can reinsert and pretend that you're believing about these things again. So it's difficult.
I agree that faith, part of this is, I say, we put everything on a physical level. Scientists sometimes try to do the work. Physicists will try to do the work that only a metaphysician should be doing. And metaphysics means the reality that's beyond reality. It's real, but it's not material. Like in common parlance, we'll say, oh, I'm a realist. I believe in what my senses tell me. Well, let me tell you something. I'm a realist, and I believe in a lot of what's beyond the possibility of sense perception. In fact, to put it in a nutshell, if you go back to that old quibble between the nominalist and the realist of the Middle Ages, I'm on the side of the realist, who, and I believe that reality is beyond. We say it's real if you use logic and sensorial perception. Oh, I'm not saying that's unreal, but I'm saying there's metaphysical realities beyond that. And they're realer, in fact, than what comes to us through our senses. But we're hunched down. If you just rely on sensorial perception, sensation, you're destroying real human potential, the spiritual potential a human being has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because in particularly in Christianity, and this is the meaning of Pontiff Pope, we are a bridge between heaven and earth. An animal is at one with earth. We are in ways, we're in the earth, we have an earthly life, but we also have a part of us that opens to heaven, which is the celestial reality. And if we try and crush that, it often makes our material life worse, actually. You wouldn't think it would, but it often does.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, where do you think the science in itself is going right now? It seems like, you know, some of the new fields that have started to emerge of, everything from, you know, looking for what they call the God particle to quantum physics. And I know that some people, you know, kind of look at that kind of somewhat skeptical as well. But it seems that it's a new age interpretation of that is coming out of that field. It's not going back to a belief in a Christian God per se, although some people seem to reignite some kind of spirituality. The closer they get into the atomic level, the closer they get to the mysteries that goes beyond the boundary which they cannot cross.
Well, that's all a materialistic universe. So it may be sort of expanding our understanding of what the materialistic universe is, but that's what it is, and that can encompass God, because God is more than the material universe. And this sounds to me like what's really escaping them. And if they want to find God, I think they need to go back to spiritual traditions and listen to that. That does sound ridiculous to me. There's a man I read, Wolfgang Smith. He writes a lot about this. Now, he's a real scientist. He's old now, but he did things like when they were developing rockets, and they needed to find out what angle a rocket would need to come. Yeah, when it comes back into the atmosphere, if it's too wide, it just bounces off. If it's too narrow, it burns up. He was one of the people, at least, who figured out the exact formula of how to get a rocket back into the atmosphere. So he has that precise knowledge, but he's very religious. And he talks about what he calls scientism and says that science is fine on its own level, but when it gets into creating myths, then we've got, and I fear that's what these people are doing. They're creating myths.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think we can try to get a little closer to the idea of reigniting something that you'd like to see in Europe. And what do you think that would do for Europe? I mean, in what direction can it go? Is it simply about, and I don't mean this in a condescending way, but is it merely about going backwards, back in time, or is it about going with where we are from right now and go forward and do something? I don't mean a reformation or turning it into something which is not, but it surely it has to, for it to be attractive to people, it has to be something there which they desire, right?
Well, yes. Well, right now, I'm not interested in going backwards or forwards. I'm interested in eternity or the eternal present or what the mystics call the now. And this may, and you get that through following the spiritual teachings. Yes, it would be good to have a spiritual renewal. Whether or not that can happen, I don't know. I can't save any collective myself. You know, I can just reflect and see what I see. And I don't know. I don't know how the future will work out.
Yeah.
And I don't believe in going forward. And you can, if you go backward, that's another problem. But you can access eternity. And if I like sometimes studying history in past ages, it's because they too sort of partook of eternity. And what I don't like is an attempt to live in the present flow as a flow. You know, to just be in the present in such a way that you think nothing or anybody else has a past, or even for that matter, has a future. But that's why I said something like faith. That's the first thing. People have to, I think that if people can feel the presence of greater realities and of God, that will slowly help and gain guidance in other ways.
What about the European? It seems to be a European trait of European people, that their need to understand things and to a certain extent deconstruct them to find out what makes them tick. Is that something then that has been?
Well, they don't need. I think for one thing, when I brought up metaphysics, I think Europeans, in particular. I used to read a man, Fritjof Schuen, a lot of people don't like him, who was talking about this. Some Semitic peoples can just sort of be given a moral law, and that's good. Well, we'll do the moral law. But I think Europeans need not to just understand things on the level of sensation, but to understand metaphysics. The great example of this, if you want to do Indo-European, are the Hindus, who have elaborate structures of metaphysics and all that. And I think this is integral to the European soul. Now, in some ways, I will say that with the Christian world, they sort of hid from that need. But I think without that, people of European backgrounds won't be happy.
Yeah.
Maybe people of other backgrounds can be happy. I don't know. I'm not going to say they can or can't. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Now, so it's not about picking up a tradition of going to church on Sundays. That's not what this is about.
Well, that's because that won't do you any good if this other thing's unoperative. You can pass a law that everybody has to go to church, but that'll just give people one more law to break.
Yeah,
you know,
of course. So it's very tricky to know about what direction to go to reevaluate. I mean, I'm with you on the sense of the fact that we need to develop a spiritual life. I think we disagree in what direction to go, but we're on the same page when it comes to the fact that we are dying. Europeans are in a position where we are retreating and going backwards because we don't have this a spiritual sense of things. We don't have this kind of fervor that some of the other people do that are spiritually or at least religiously, I should say, religiously inclined, which are in some cases seeking to spread the message of Islam to all the world, and they're seeing the invasion into Europe as an aspect of a religious war. You know,
I know it's terrible, and we don't have, you know, in the old days we defended Christendom. And, I keep asking every day, where is Charles Martel?
yeah. He's out killing Saxons. No, I'm just joking. Yeah.
Unfortunately, he did that, didn't he? I know.
Yeah. This is what I'm talking about. You know, that horrible divisive thing. I'm not saying that European tribes weren't fighting before that. It's kind of like the Native American argument.
Oh, yes. Of course
they were. It was just it was organized on a way, and it was a new type of problem that came into the picture, basically. But we don't have to, you know, dwell too much on that. So Jenny, before we wrap things up for this time, it's been an interesting discussion. Of course, there's tons more things to say about all of these things, but it's just an opening to this issue of where Europeans stand when it comes to Christianity, how this could be helpful in our times. Because, you know, ultimately, I don't have anything against Christians, nothing at all. It doesn't matter to me as long as they're not working actively against our people, and actively also when I exclude people who believe in native European traditions. So that's not an issue at all. But is there anything else you wanted to add to our discussion? Something else from the book that you feel would be pertinent to just talk about before we wrap things up for this time?
Yes, I wrote the book. Dante wrote about hell, purgatory, and paradise. One interesting thing about this book is it's about purgatory, which is getting to be very much a lost tradition. I read somewhere in the Catholic Church they don't talk much about purgatory. It's a doctrine, so they can't quite just dump it. In the Eastern Church, they had a very interesting way of looking at it, which they say they would have 40 days after death. Now, 40 is a very symbolical number. Keep that in mind. The soul, or the soul that is saved, if you're not saved, you're just out of this process altogether. The soul that is saved goes through various stages they call the toll houses. And you repent of each of your sins, or the toll houses are the same number as the Hebrew alphabet. What it implies, and what gets implied in Dante's Purgatory, is you're dropping illusions. We tend to, in our earthly life, wrap ourselves in all sorts of illusions. And after death, in order to ascend, we drop these illusions one by one by one. This isn't quite the traditional Catholic view of purgatory, where we just burn it all out or something, but that's a deep thing. Now, the problem with the Eastern idea of the toll houses is if you mention them in a lot of churches, people will get on your case.
Mm-hmm.
I was an Orthodox Christian for a long time, and they just, and the only way you can shut them up is to start talking about purgatory, and they hate that more. But it's a shame, because for one thing, there's a tradition, what we call paradise, is a very high state, and it's not easy to get completely there. We need to go through transformations, even after death. And the reason I didn't my book, Ordeal of Mercy, is that it's a mercy to be able to go through those transitions. Otherwise, we would never get to paradise. And it reminds me of, it's fashionable these days to believe in reincarnation. But there are thinkers, I know Ananda Kumara Swami was one of them, who said that when you look at the Oriental idea theories on reincarnation, it might have been a popular belief that you come back as some relative or whatever. But what transmigration or reincarnation is going through these various stages until you reach the transcendent point you're trying to reach. In fact, if you look at Buddhism, a lot of Westerners say, oh, I'm a Buddhist, I believe in reincarnation. The traditional Buddhist view of reincarnation is it was awful. You were on the wheel of life and death. And the whole thing, the whole reason for a spiritual path was to get beyond that wheel, just like a Christian getting to heaven, that you go through a lot. And you might be able to become a saint and do that, do the whole thing in this life. That's not ruled out. But it's a deep tradition that that's not necessarily the case.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah. We've talked on about, you know, the some of the Hindu traditions and the yuga mm-hmm. cycles and, you know,
yeah.
All mm-hmm. of that. It's quite interesting. I think it has to, it is definitely related to the Indo-Aryan or the Indo-European tradition overall, and there is some kind of a, you know, it's intersected there in some capacity. And I think some of the later European traditions definitely, you know, borrowed, and not borrowed, but it's an extension to a lot of the things that comes to us through some of the old Hindu works, basically. So there's a fascinating material there to be delved uh-huh. into, for sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wanted to mention as well, you have you mentioned the book about Dante's Inferno. It's called Dark Way to Paradise, and it's available for people if they go to charles-upton.com.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And just click on the, or go over the menu that's called Works, and then click on Jennifer, is it Duane? Duane?
Doan,
sorry, yeah. Jennifer Doan Upton. Yeah, Jennifer Doan Upton. Just click on that. We'll add a link to that, folks, so you can just find it, and there's the books are available there. Dark Way to Paradise and Black Sun, and then of course upcoming, as we've been talking about, is The Ordeal of Mercy as well.
Mm-hmm. And the Black Sun is the old poems. I like the poems, and a little press here did them, and I don't do poetry readings, so I wanted to advertise that book.
Right. Yeah. Well, definitely, we'll have links up to the book, and then of course it's going to be also the publisher we can mention, angelicopress.com. We'll have a link up to this, but it's believed to be available at the end of November, so we'll add a link to it.
Yes, and maybe before then, I don't know.
We'll make sure to add a link to it once it's up on available on the websites, so that people, if people are listening in the archives in the future, you should be able to see a book link available. But all right, well, thank you so much, Jenny, for coming on with us. I really appreciate it. But it was great talking with you, and it's always good to hear about some of the different perspectives that we might not agree mm-hmm. with, but I think we have a lot of other things in common. So thank you again for joining us. It was great to have you here.
I like that you talk to people with different perspectives. I really like that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much again. I appreciate your time.
All right.
It's been good to have you with us today. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to hear more radio, redicecreations.com or RedEyesRadio.net is the site. The full archives for our subscribers is at RedEyesMembers.com. Over 1,000 shows. Go there to check it out. We are going to be back with Pete Papaheraklis and Victor Thorne from American Free Press talking about their book America's Racial Powder Keg on Friday. We'll talk to you then. Have a great rest of your day.